Hi everyone, it's Eli. You know how sometimes you stumble upon something truly game-changing in healthcare? Well, I found it. Kinetisense. This cutting-edge motion capture technology is transforming movement, assessment, and recovery. Imagine getting instant AI-driven insights without any wearables on your patient. That's right, no ping pong balls needed. Just pure, accurate data. Perfect for boosting athletic performance, pinpointing imbalances, and refining rehab. Top professionals worldwide trust Kinetisense to maximize productivity and results. Check out our partner page to learn more. Experience the revolution in movement. Welcome to Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More, the podcast that gives you a viewpoint in sports medicine that can't be found anywhere else. I'm your host, Eli Halleck, and we have a fantastic show ahead of us today. So let's get started. And with that, we'd like to welcome our first guest, Dietrich Riley. He is a former high school All-American athlete. He went on to play UCLA football team, where he had a stellar career until, unfortunately, there was a dramatic life-altering injury that we'll discuss a little bit today. He's moved forward in his career using his characteristics developed in football, his stunning good looks, and his brain to where he is today. We know today that Dietrich is a coach. He does it for fun. He volunteers for the youth. Dietrich, welcome. Nice to have you, buddy. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, gentlemen. Thank you.
So we also have with us today Gabriel Halleck, former high school and youth football coach.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for being here.
And also our usual contributor, or will be usual contributor, Joel Dorning, high school athletic trainer.
Thank you for having me.
Dietrich, first off, it's been a pleasure knowing you for several years now. We've known each other, 10, 15 years. It's been wonderful watching you develop into the young man you've become. What characteristics did you admire growing up in coaches?
I would say number one is leadership, being able to handle kids from all different walks of life, different personalities. And number two, having the patience, because you know, as you mentioned earlier, how, you know, I volunteer and do coaching myself nowadays, just being able to step into that role. It doesn't matter how athletic you were or how good of a player you were, but in order, because at the end of the day, it's all instinctual as you're playing, you know, but when you have to put your shoes into, put your feet into the shoes of the athlete or the person that you're coaching, it's much different. You have to kind of simplify into ABC terms rather than, you know, when you're playing, you're just out there. It's like muscle memory. It's like riding a bike. It's just doing something that you're so familiar with. Just to be able to receive information in a much clearer perspective, but also being able to translate it out there to others. You know, that's one thing I always admired from the likes of, you know, Coach Bonds and all my other previous coaches, just being able to going down in a game, facing adversity or whatnot, being able to rally up, you know, your team, and also being able to like push out a message so everyone can receive it well. But I would definitely say patience and leadership are, you know, the two, you know, two traits that stick out to me for coaches.
At a young age, I presume people identified you as a pretty decent athlete. About what time frame do you remember kind of figuring out athletics was something you excelled at, something you were good at, but at the same time, something you loved?
I would say from when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my mom had gotten me the San Francisco 49ers full pads. She gave me like the helmet, the shoulder pads, the whole uniform. And I just remember getting in a 3-point stance naturally. That's when I knew just football was just something I was enamored with. But in terms of on the athletic standpoint, I was a late bloomer. Growing up, I was always physical. My first year of tackle was a humbling experience, to say the least, because in flag football, you know, I was free safety. I was a receiver. I did it all. And then when I got to my first year in tackle, what they do? Hey, son, we need you to put your hand in that dirt. I was an offensive lineman my first year of tackle. I was a left tackle. And then I also was a defensive end. or D tackle, sorry. I was more of like a hybrid. So I thought I was going to come out and be a skilled player because the year before, you know, in flag football, I had about 9 interceptions. And here I am having to, you know, play with guys that are older than me as well, much more athletic. But that also instilled the confidence and toughness in me, you know, being able to put my hand in the dirt, play with guys that are older than me. I was always the youngest on each and every team. So as I, you know, went from Gremlin all the way up to junior peewee to junior midget, I was always playing against, you know, guys that were older than me. It just made me tougher. And then around 8th grade is when I knew I was starting to like kind of take off. That's when I started, you know, my workouts have gotten more, you know, tougher. I started working with, you know, personal trainers. And then I went on to go to the Junior Olympics for track and field to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And then that's when I, you know, after that year in Pop Warner, my last year in 8th grade, coaches would come up to me and opposing teams would come up to me and tell me like, yo, man, you're special. Like, I could definitely see you playing at the next level. And then, you know, when I got to high school, it was just take advantage of the God-given talents that I was, you know, presented. But like I said, I was a late bloomer. You know, I was never the most skillful player growing up. I was always told, you man, you gotta slow two-step. I wasn't the fastest.
Man, I never saw you slow, so that's kind of funny. But we've got some good stories about your high school career, and we've always discussed them. Kind of cool to know that you started out playing Pop Warner and worked your way up. In that time frame, I'm sure you came across a ton of coaches in your career. Some of them looking out for your best interest, but not always. And that's kind of one of the things that concerns, I know, Joel and myself, in what we do in healthcare as certified athletic trainers, that there's not always somebody out there looking out for the kid, looking out for the athlete. Did you ever experience that situation where something happened either to you or one of your buddies on the team and you knew something wasn't right, yet that coach was pushing him to play or pushing him to get back in when even you as a young kid knew it just wasn't a good situation?
Absolutely. Like, you know, just to rewind, like I was saying, back to Pop Warner, you're young, you're naive, you're just out there having fun with your friends. But for some reason, you know, the drills we were doing, even as, like I said, at a young age, I would just think twice about it. I'm like, wow, well, there's an unfair advantage to one of the players. Like, we would always do a tackling drill. It would be a 2 versus 1. 2 defenders were about 10 yards apart. So you have 2 defenders literally going to go head up with a ball carrier. So doing drills like that, for example, I'm like, there's no way, you know, as you get older, you go to high school, you go to the next level, you're doing a drill like that. And I would just see kids getting laid out left and right. And I'm just, you know, luckily I was able to hold my own, if I was a ball carrier or, you know, on the tackling end. But just seeing that drill from a young mental state of mine, sometimes I would question it. And I was just like, all right, I guess they're just trying to make us tougher. I don't know. But I would see kids, like I said, that were just getting, you know, get carried off the field. And guess what? They're back hitting the next day in practice. Those are little things like that wouldn't fly in today's society, because back then we were just told to just buckle up your chin strap and guess what? Go play. Scratch off a bruise. I'd love to see where the game is heading now. There's pros and cons to it, but I do like to say that I like to say that they're looking out for players, you know, health and safety. It's back then, like I said, it was just tons of drills we were doing that just it didn't look out for the players. And I could see it really, and that's probably why it may have taken a toll on us as we gotten older.
Is one of those drills, if I can jump in real quick, Dietrich, Oklahoma?
Yeah, we did Oklahoma, but I'm saying this one literally, because the Oklahoma, you have the offensive lineman going against the D lineman, then you have the ball carrier and the defender back, and then they have just, you know, sometimes the D lineman will kind of fight off the offensive lineman, and guess what they would tackle. But this one was specifically a ball carrier, just literally a ball carrier,
yeah,
running straight at 2 defenders, like literally, like just trying to split them. And
so 2-on-1.
2-on-1. And
or 2-on-1 or 3-on-1. It depended, you know, if I can jump in, you know, it depended on who the coach was and that coach's mood. I remember when I was a freshman, I didn't play youth football until I got to high school. And yeah, I could go on for days about the quality of coaches that I had when I was a freshman. But that'll be in our grievance episode podcast. Oh, I just remember the coaches picking out the little guys and having them go up against the big guys and lining up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody, there was a, on our freshman team, there was approximately, you know, maybe let's round it off at 100 kids. You know, half of them have never played before. I was one of those half, and they'd pick the biggest kid.
Oh, yeah.
Put him up against the littlest kid.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They'd go at it, and then they'd giggle, and they'd have the little kid or the big kid do it again.
Of course. And then back then, like in Pop Warner, and I don't know why my mom didn't come, you know, across and, you know, whack me up against the side of the head. But
because if anybody's after, mother would have.
She would have done it.
It would have been yours. Yeah, definitely.
This is how the kids used to think back then. I don't, like I said, they're not doing it nowadays. We would compare at the end of the practice who had the most stick marks on the helmet. We would go up.
Oh, yeah.
Let me see your helmet. Oh, man, you're not hitting hard enough. Oh, you're not hitting. And sometimes we'll try and bang each other's helmets across. Just, you know, just holding the helmet. You got one guy that would just do it. And we're just looking at each other like, man, I'm trying to have the most stick marks because that's going to make me come off as more intimidating to my opponent. Uh-huh. And it's so funny. I would watch the NFL games not even knowing that they would paint their helmets and stuff. But I would just look at their helmets and I'm like, wow, they're not using their helmets. Like they must not be hitting hard enough. Like,
they're not really tough in the NFL. No, not at all.
I remember one kid, he had a crayon and he would put the marks on the front of his helmet before the games.
Oh, yeah.
So the other team would think he's harder than they are.
Oh, yeah.
And they might go slower.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. It's just the things we were doing back then. It was just so backwards. Yeah, it's crazy to see how the game, like I said, has progressed. And I'm just glad to see that, you know, it's minimal days and pads and things like that. And I'm sure we'll probably get into that later on. But yeah, it just never, if it didn't favor the athletes.
Now, as you started going through Pop Warner up into high school, obviously, I've got a little more knowledge about your high school experience. Did you notice a change or a difference in the coaching level, coaching attitude, or knowledge and how they took care of business?
It's night and day. I would say I kind of got a little bit of an introduction into like film and things like that from my flag football coach that I played with recreational. So I was doing flag football and tackle in the same season. And I guess that's what made me so, you know, competitive and also kept me in shape. But my coach kind of like, we on Mondays, we would watch Monday Night Football and he would kind of like break down X's and O's. So that kind of got me familiarized with the game. But then when I got to high school, I'm like, wait, we actually have to watch film? Then our coaches, you know, Coach Bonds and Coach Gibbons, rather than sitting at the lunch tables, being able to enjoy your lunch and stuff, no, we're in a classroom and we're breaking down film. Then also, not only that, once we're done with film, right before practice, oh, we're getting scouting reports. So this was just, I'm, you know, 14 years old on the varsity level and having to read a scouting report about who we're going against. So it's not just about, oh, let me just go out there and try and finesse it and just try and just go off of a skill level and outperform my opponent. No, you need to know it on the actual, like the grand scheme of things on how to prepare for your opponent. So it makes the game much easier. And as I noticed, each and every week, I've gotten more and more smarter, and I will, you know, spend time with our coaches and ask questions. But it was just all about the preparation. It's not just about what you see on the final product on the field that Friday night. It's all about what goes into it, you know, having to do a offensive, defensive scout teams and things like that. I'm like, I wasn't used to that.
So what you're saying right now is you're breaking the stereotype that football players are actually smart.
Oh, man.
That's what you're saying. You got to study.
Some are. I've had some teammates, even on the collegiate level, that didn't watch an ounce of film. And guess what? They were having to fall right into an interception, being in the right place, right time. But you know, that's just, some players can be freakish like that. Just you know, it's all about, it has some luck involved into it. But yeah, you definitely have to watch a lot of film and know what you have to do. Because at the end of the day, you break assignment, guess what? The team is going to, they'll find that. And you got the coaches up there, you know, with those binoculars and things like that. And they're willing to, you know, find the weakness and the holes in the offense or defense.
Looking back, your high school career, you did fairly well. Good career, both academically and on the field. High school All-American, USC comes calling. Coach Carroll comes knocking on your door. He was at, God, I couldn't keep track of how many games. He stood there at the goalpost watching you play.
St. Paul, my senior year.
Yep. I remember that. Just stood there the whole game watching you. He was all in. And what did you like about Coach Carroll at that time? Because I know you were leaning to USC. Sorry, all our Bruin fans, but you were really leaning to SC and Coach Carroll. What was it about him as a coach? I know I've read a lot about him, but never met him. What was it about him that really made you want to play for him?
Funny story, I'll never forget. I was going to the camps in seventh grade. So it felt like he was family, him and his whole staff, offense, defense, special teams. Like I said, they watched me grow up and ascend into, you know, the man I was becoming. Like I said, it was a family atmosphere, number one. It was just a comfort. You know, I was spending all my summers there at all the camps. And so I was able to understand their coaching style, understand the excellence that he demanded, but he made it fun. You know, whether, you know, before our camps, he would come in, everyone's shirts off, everyone's waving their towels, everyone's going crazy. So I'm like, man, now it makes sense why they're able to have the success with his team, because it all begins with the family atmosphere. You're having fun. It's just not, you're just going out there to, you know, oh, I need to go out to practice. Like, you're dreading the whole experience. Like, no, you look forward to these moments. And then also everything was, I had a theme, whether it's Turnover Tuesday, he made it. So when you got to the game, it wasn't going to be overwhelming, but he was just straightforward with me, you know. And I always loved offense. I love having the ball in my hands. I love just, you know, Reggie Bush, all those players, Adrian Peterson. So I always envisioned myself scoring touchdowns. And I'll never forget going into my sophomore year, I'm literally lined up to run the 40-yard dash. And I ran, about a 4.5. And then he was like, what position are you? What are you going into this season? I was like, I'm going to play running back. And him and it was Coach Rocky Seto. They were like, I think for the second half of the camp, you should move over to the defensive side of ball. And that landed me a scholarship offer. Because, you know, Coach Carroll, he loves defensive backs. He loves tall ones. He loves the fast, long
stride. They've got to be at least 5'11 or higher. About exactly. 195. Yeah, I know his type.
He's tall, you know, skinny, you know, long stride. Like I said, you know, he wants his physical corners. He has a particular style, like a Richard Sherman type. And he didn't tell me to go to safety. He wanted me to go to corner. But that was the interaction. Like I said, led to me receiving a scholarship offer that day. And it was exciting. But yeah, man, Pete Carroll, he was family.
And I remember when you came back to camp sophomore year and they had moved you to DB. And all of a sudden, you started hitting. And as an athletic trainer, Joel and I will sit there and go, oh, okay, here's another kid. Oh, okay, here's another kid. Oh, whoa, 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 wait a minute. When you wrapped up, and you know that was always my thing with you, wrap up. When you wrap up and hit somebody, oh, my God, it was beautiful. I loved, and this is horrible as an athletic trainer to say, I liked watching you hit because it was so textbook. And the velocity you came through, it almost reminded me, and going back to Gabe, one of his favorite players, Ronnie Lott, how you would just put a bullseye on somebody and go right through them and wrap up and drive them to the ground. And I love that your sophomore year. I vividly remember watching you sophomore year, just wrapping up, bringing people to the ground, textbook, perfect. There's no doubt why you wouldn't get a scholarship when a coach sees that. So yep. that was a lot of fun to watch back in those days.
And like you said, wrapping up and taking the extra step, Los Altos, I'll never forget that game. And we had, the running back was Bryce McBride. He was fast as a lightning bolt, short, compact running back. I remember just watching that film leading up to that week. And I'm like, I got my work cut out for me. Like I was, you know, had some, you know, butterflies going into that game because he was big. He was physical. He was so fast. Agility was second to none. I just remember I'm at free safety and I was coming down. And I just remember, I was like, hey, I have nothing to lose. And I was just coming up. I was just lighting them up. And I remember I ended up just coming. It was one of my favorite tackles and favorite plays to this day. He was going down his left. He's going literally, he did a toss sweep and I'm on their sideline and I just literally go. It was the most perfect angle tackle. Like my helmet wasn't involved. It was all shoulder. And I just ran through him.
I like how you say there was no helmet involved.
No helmet involved.
Yep, I appreciate that.
No helmet involved. And I just remember I did that about two plays in a row. And I was just like, oh, yeah, this is my game right here. And then also there's another play when they threw a quick screen to their, you know, they had a jittery slot a slot receiver that was so – he was very quick as well. And I remember I broke his ribs, and it was one of those plays that I didn't wrap up, but I was like – I took the extra step, and I just ran through him and put my forearm into his rib and broke his rib, and he was down for the rest of the game. But, yeah, it was some plays I left on that field that game. But those are some highlights, from those plays that stuck out for me just with perfect technique and just, you know, knowing my angles, knowing where my help was as well.
Now, I know you say hits you love and Los Al. I remember that game really well. But there's one hit that anybody talks about you, they always remember. Yeah, and that's the one you knocked the helmet off the running back at, I believe it was Oregon State.
Yeah.
You just got that guy on that sideline. He knew he ran into Dietrich Riley when that happened. You can watch that over and over and over. And I believe it was ESPN was going nuts for that hit. So do you remember that one at all?
I do. And for that to be my biggest highlight of my career, it didn't feel like it. Meaning when I hit him, it didn't feel hard at all. Like I just was just like one, you know, my chin strap came unbuckled a bit. But like I said, when I hit him, it just felt like I tapped him because it was, I don't know how, it was the perfect shoulder placement. There was no helmet involved, of course. I don't know how that led to that impact and for his helmet to fall off. Because like I said, when I hit him, I got up and I was just like kind of confused. And if you see the highlight, it looks like I'm standing over him a bit, but I'm just like, all right, I see his helmet is off. Like, how did that just happen? But like, it was just the angle. Thank God to my corner. I always tell him, you know, to this day when I see him, I was like, yo, man, you're a reason why I had this play because you can't do this anymore. But he had a pulling lineman coming at him. He literally blew up the play, chopped the lineman, and that forced the running, that forced Jaquizz Rodgers to jump. And that's what led me to having that hit. Yeah, man. Like I said, it didn't feel like it was a big hit. It's crazy.
That was a hell of an impact. I was watching that video last night, actually, just reliving some moments that we watched you play. When you did decide UCLA, Coach Carroll goes to Seattle, where he's just leaving now, unfortunately. I know a lot of players, there's a lot of talk. They're all disappointed about him leaving that program just because of the person he is. Right. You go to a coach that has a great reputation and a great coaching staff. What was your experience with them?
At UCLA, it was up and down my freshman year because, you know, I was coming in expecting to play a pivotal role, but I had to really put my pride and ego aside because I had to learn how to watch film, not blow assignments, because that was the only thing that was holding me back from being a starter as a freshman was, you know, I was making great plays in practice, but guess what? I was blowing a lot of assignments. So I had to learn how to really watch film. And I did not know how to do that. I was just watching, oh, okay, all right, yeah, this player's doing this. All right, cool. Yeah, this guy's fast. This guy isn't. This is where the weaknesses are. But really understanding the X and O's, the schematics, and really understanding down and distance personnel, 12 personnel, 11 personnel, 13 personnel, 22 personnel. So it was so many things I did not understand. And I had to really just ask questions.
Elevate your knowledge, ignite your curiosity, and compete with the best minds at events hosted by the American Academic Competition Institute. AACI's sports medicine competitions feature practical exercises, challenging quizzes, specialty tests, and keynote speakers that foster knowledge and social engagement in healthcare and sports medicine. Go to AACITest.org for more information on upcoming regional and national competitions. Sign up for the Ultimate Intellectual Showdown.
Like I said, my freshman year is up and down, but as the season went along, the coaches realized, like, all right, he's starting to catch on to it. We could start throwing him in more packages. Funny story, my first start was at Oregon, Thursday night showdown. This is their national championship team. They have, you know, LaMichael James. They have Jeff Mayo. They have Kenyon Barner. This is the team that went on to play, you know, Auburn in the national championship versus Cam Newton. Chip Kelly was there. Their tempo was so fast. When I was going in on nickel packages, not base. So when it's nickel, I'm running in, I'm the safety. We slide our other safety down to nickel, boom. And their tempo was so fast, I'm running to the boundary because I'm coming from the far side of our sideline. And I'm trying to like look over to our sideline. I missed the play call because their tempo is so fast. Nowadays, guess what? You're able to do substitution, right? Back then you couldn't. So it always favored the offense. So as I'm getting to the side, running to my spot to get lined up, I missed the call. I'm supposed to be man on on LaMichael James, who runs a swing pattern, breaks for 40 yards. Guess what? I get pulled for the rest of the game. Little things like that. I just had to kind of like, you know, take it with a grain of salt, man. But little moments like that, man, I was like, all right, sometimes I gotta prepare better, or the coaching staff gotta be realistic and help me out, you know. But yeah, man, it was my freshman year's rocky. We came in 4-6, and I'm seeing all my other peers go to other schools and excel. I'm on the same recruiting trip as Tyron Matthew at LSU. He's, you know, the MVP for his bowl game versus Texas A&M. I'm seeing all my other guys at, you know, Oklahoma ball out, and I'm like, all right, I'm here in a rotation, you know, not starting. So I had to really, it was kind of disappointing my freshman year. I had high expectations and didn't fulfill them.
You see that going on. They do that little route, 40 yards, he's gone. And you think back, Pop Warner, think back to high school, think back to now college. What was the reaction of the coaches to you, Pop Warner versus high school versus college? How did they coach you up? Because they had to do something to make you a better athlete. I'm sure some of them yelled, some of them screamed, some of them were better at educating you than others. What are some of the horror stories of the coaches that didn't quite coach you up versus those coaches that did?
It was always the coaches that were the, you know, I learned best from coaches that challenged me, but that were not trying to be, how would I say it? They weren't just trying to humiliate and embarrass you. You could tell if the coaches have the player's best interests by how they instruct and how they teach. Rather than just, you know, yelling at a kid and pulling him out, no, pull the kid aside and tell him what he did wrong or what needs to be corrected. I admired those coaches, like a Coach Bonds, that was able to, he'll get on you. He holds you to a high standard, right? He's going to hold you accountable. But at the same time, he's going to tell you, all right, this is what you're doing wrong. This is what you need to improve on. Guess what? Go back out there. Show me what, you know, improve on your mistake. Now, if you're going to keep making mistakes, guess what? Your playing time is going to, I'm going to take that away from you. I've also had coaches, you know, prior to Coach Bonds that were just, like I said, they were trying to be in your face, cuss you out, yell at you and stuff like that, just to think that it's going to make you tougher. Every kid is different. Like, I have thick skin. I never take it personal. I hear the message. I don't hear the tone. So you yell at me as hard as you want, do all that stuff, but guess what? I'm listening to what you're saying so I could take that on and apply it to, you know, the next play. Then when I got to college, Jim Moore, man, like, he was incredible because he was all about, and he was a player's coach, but sometimes people throw that around loosely, player's coach, because they think player's coach is trying to be your best friend. Let's go. Hey, let's have fun. No, player's coach is meaning he understands the game from a player's lens, but also he's looking out for his players in terms of, you practice hard, I'll compensate you with, we'll be on this field for an hour. And guess what? We're off the field. We're not going to be out here for 2.5 hours. He looked out for the players. He heard us. He always, from the captains of the defense, captains of the offense, for each position group, he would want to hear us out. All right, what are things we can improve on, whether it's from the uniforms, whatever it may be? What can we do differently? I've always admired the coaches that could really just have the patience to teach the players, not just yell at them, because at the end of the day, I understand your job is on the line as a coach, being able to lead in the right way. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I understand that. All of us have seen the coaches that do it the right way, do it the wrong way. I've seen coaches screaming at kids where we've actually, as an athletic trainer, had to step in between the coach and the kid and pretend we were built a Kevlar and take it, because no kid should have to deal with what some of the athletes do. I can remember a football coach from, oh geez, it's over 25 years ago. He was going off about a kid who had a dislocated and fractured finger, how he needed to get back in the game. Get back in the game, get back in the game. This is a sophomore, junior, and just going nuts on him. And I stepped in. I'm like, no, surgery. This is surgical. You can tell. He physically threatened me.
Yeah.
Cocked his hand back, went to punch me. And I said, you know, go right ahead. I'll own your house. And he was huge. He was a former D1 linebacker. Yeah. I'm thinking, man, if he makes contact, I'm done. Absolutely done. He's going to knock me out. All the players are going to have seen it. I'm never going to live it down. He'll be in jail. But, hey, I got his house, so that's okay. It amazes me sometimes some of the stuff that coaches say to these kids, whether it's Pop Warner, high school, or you hear stories about college. I'm not in the college level anymore. But you see it, you hear it, you know it, and you hear it from athletes. They generally don't lie. But then you turn around and now you're a coach. And how do you interact with those kids, or how do you help a coach that maybe doesn't have that skill set?
That's so funny you ask that, because I never, ever would imagine myself, you know, stepping into the coach's world. I want to make sure my players, the kids that I work with, are disciplined. Yet, if they make a mistake, I'm very mindful on how if they do something that can affect the team or whatnot. It's a difference between implementing discipline or just yelling just to be heard. You get what I'm saying? So I would have to, rather than humiliate and embarrass a kid, say if they make a mistake, I'll pull the kid aside, have a sub go in, tell him what he did wrong, and then guess what? Give him a chance to go out there and redeem himself. I guess because I've learned to become so patient as I've gotten older, I like to just lead differently, because everyone has their own different coaching styles, you know? And also, I'm very mindful about the parents around. These parents nowadays are different. They're not how they were back then. Like our parents.
We have no idea what you're talking about.
We're gonna save that conversation for the podcast.
That's a whole different podcast. I believe Joel would agree. There's absolutely nothing you can say.
Oh my gosh.
That is negative towards
I'm gonna mute myself before I say something.
We have some parents that, you know, they bring their kid out. Oh, my kid's a quarterback. Then they can't complete an out route or a slant. But guess what? My kid is a quarterback. All right, fair enough. Like I said, I'm always for making continuous mistakes. Yeah, I'm going to make sure, you know, we pay for it. We're going to go out there. We're going to run some wind sprints. Yeah, we're going to learn from our mistakes. We're going to teach you guys. But at the same time, we're not just about to be out there and just be, you know, nutcases. Because guess what? These coaches nowadays, you would think that it's all for them. All right, we win this game. We're reacting as if we're playing. Like, no, our days are far gone. Like, it's all about the kids at the end of the day. I want to make sure the kids are having fun, because if I'm continuously, you know, picking on the same kid or whatnot, or yelling at these kids, that could make them no longer want to play again. And I don't want to be that coach. That won't sit well with me.
So are you saying that some coaches actually are living their dream through some of the kids still playing? I find that hard to believe. I never see that.
Oh, hey. I'm telling you, man, it's crazy. I've seen it all, especially the 7-on-7 world today. First of all, this is new, right? It just had started to, like, grow and prosper when I was in high school, my sophomore year. But, yeah, the 7-on-7 world, man, it's giving false enthusiasm to these coaches. And, you would think they were playing. I'm like, hey, sit down aside. Unless you want to go tit for tat, let me see your game footage. If you were actually that guy, then we'll talk. But I've had coaches, you know, kind of like bitter, you know, chip at us from a distance, but we've always carried ourselves differently because, one, we understand where we're at, and we understand it's far beyond us. And we want to lead by example for these kids. We want to be great citizens and be great role models. And we want the parents to see that as well. Like, yeah, we're going to coach your kids tough, but at the same time, we always hold their best interests.
Now, if I can jump in real quick, Dietrich, I've had the privilege to know you for a long, long time. And, you know, not just that, but I know the coaches that have coached you, you know, when you were, you know, when I was at St. Francis and you were coming in, and some of those coaches that were with you in Pop Warner, you know, they came up, I got to know them, and they were quality coaches. You had some really good people to mentor you, to shape you, so to speak. Not everybody had that. You know, they didn't. Not a lot of kids had that. I was one of those kids that didn't have that in high school. Again, we're going to save that for the episode on grievances. From what I heard you say a couple minutes ago, if I can backtrack for a second, your interaction with your players, you're using that as teachable moments, right? To where one of your players makes a mistake. You pull him aside, you take him out of the game. You're not barking on him while he's on the field. You're not humiliating him in front of his parents. You're pulling him aside one-on-one, you know, you and him. You're telling him what he did wrong. You're letting another kid, another student, another player perform, and now he gets to go back out. There's no coaching certification that qualifies everybody. Some people, you know, they're like sponges. It's like coaches are like parents, and the players are like kids. Yep. You know, you're going to emulate the people that taught you. And it's not the same for everybody. And I'm glad it happened to you, you know, because I know some of the students that you're coaching now and some of their parents, and You know, they speak the world of you, you know, so keep it up, man. Good for you.
Thank you. I just want the kids, most importantly, not every kid's going to go on and become a Division I prospect. But at the end of the day, I want them to have fun.
Yes.
With their peers, with us. I want it to, and at the end of the day, I want to make sure that it's, because at the end of the day, it's word of mouth. So I want everyone to continue to have a positive experience, not only with myself, but with my staff. And we want them to continue to come back because
absolutely.
They're going to, at the end of the day, the product speaks for itself. And we want to make sure that we're developing great young men. So outside of football, when they go into the classrooms, they're going into other sports, and guess what? They're able to learn from the teachable moments that we're implementing here, you know, on the field with us.
Yeah, you're doing fantastic, son. You really are. Yeah,
I like the fact that you're saying the most important thing is not necessarily the wins and the losses, but the development of the player, the development of the young man into who he will become, which is, I know what many of the coaches you dealt with, that's what their goal was for you. And you don't hear that, you don't see that a lot anymore, which is fantastic. I mean, that's how people become better. That's how they become men outside of athletics. I mean, nowadays, you know, unfortunately, and we'll talk about what happened to you in just a minute, now you're a successful in the business realm. Unfortunately, athletics was not your end game as much as all of us were hoping for you. What some of these coaches that made a difference in your life help you develop into the person you are now?
That's the beauty of football and sports. You really learn so much from it. Dealing with adversity, being relentless, being persistent, being able to take on things with the right mindset, your preparation. And it's helped me, it's helped translate and, you know, mold me into the man I am today and, you know, become, you know, successful in the business world, and also being able to work with, you know, different people. And that's teamwork. You know, we all have the same common objective and goals. In order for things to get achieved, we all have to be on the same page and not a different chapter. It just made me become so much more appreciative of all the life lessons I learned in football. So I just want to continue to just, you know, use those tools and continue to just, you know, hit the ground running and just continue to be the best version of myself daily.
And we know you use those tools to model for a while. You did that for several years. Now you're a real estate broker in the Beverly Hills area, doing very well for yourself. I'm sure mom's proud of you. Haven't seen her in a while, so please tell her I said hello.
Will do.
Thinking back and going back to that one day that did change everything in the direction of what would be your future. That game, that unfortunate hit that caused basically the same injury that Peyton Manning had. And as a defender who has to swivel and look and see, that must have been really not just physically difficult, but mentally difficult to deal with. I know personally, you're not my kid, you're not my son, but like you said, we take care of our athletes as if they are sometimes.
Yeah.
And when I started getting the phone calls of what happened, because I'll be honest, I wasn't watching the game at the moment. I flipped on and I couldn't leave to get to you quick enough. And I realized that's not my gig. That's not my job. This is the medical staff there. This is the coaching staff there. This is your mom. Knowing your mom, I could only imagine. At that moment and the unfortunate, and as you said, it was a complete accident. We've talked about it so many times. Mm-hmm. What role did those coaches and that athletic training staff and your family play for you in that pivotal moment in time over the course of those next couple of weeks also?
Man, it was when the injury first occurred, and hats goes off to the UCLA medical staff and, you know, even yourself, everyone in the medical field, to be able to have composure and to keep the athlete relaxed as if everything is fine. That's something you undermine and you really don't think too deeply of. And I just remember, you know, they weren't yelling at me. They were just keeping me like, hey, don't move. Keep your arm in the hold here, do this, don't move. Like, they weren't yelling at me. Like, because if they would have yelled at me, that probably made me more like likely to be, you know, more tense than unsettled in that episode. So the medical staff, like I said, they were just asking me questions. They were, you know, keeping me in, you know, in the positions that needed to be in the safely protocol. They literally were, they made it seamless, man. And like I said, if they would have panicked, knowing the severity of the injury, that would have made, I don't know how I would have reacted and how things could have gone. I don't know. Everyone was on the same page, man. And I just, you know, when I got to the hospital, we did all the x-rays, MRIs, CT scans, all that stuff, you name it. But yeah, man, it was like everyone, and just even the, like you said, the next day and stuff like that, there was no physical activity. It was just making sure that we were able to diagnose the issue. And we were all able to do that and stuff, and just kind of figure out a plan to implement in order to go forward and see what was the best interest for me at hand and what my future was going to determine. But like I said, man, hats off to any, like I said, yourself, the medical, you know, you said medical staff, anyone that is in that field, to be able to just think about the athlete, but at the same time, thinking about their emotions and how they could be processing, you know, that accident.
Personally, any of us that go through that situation, it's personal. Yeah. I mean, be honest. And I would presume that the coaches that were there, it was personal them, because you're one of their kids. Mm-hmm. You are, at that moment in time, part of their family, as you kept saying. Sure. And you've got a family member down. Everybody, I hate to say the term, rallies around you, but they do, because that's all you can do. You only have so many things you can do in that situation. Medically, I know all we want to do is make sure, A, you're alive. B, you're not a spinal cord injury. You know, so we're doing all the spine board and we're doing all the carrying off. We're getting you to that hospital. We've talked about it multiple times. I know what you went through with that cervical fracture. And the first time I saw you, I almost lost it. You know, seeing you when you walked into the gym wearing that collar, and to see you walk was a huge relief, because not knowing when you were carted off that field what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But knowing how strong your tie with your mom is, knowing that she was probably right there as quickly as she could be, whether that was at the hospital or taking you to the doctors for follow-up, having a team around you, coaching staff, teammates, family, friends, how did that make a difference at that point in time for you?
And that's why I made my decision to stay home. Because imagine if I would have had that injury, God forbid, elsewhere, you know, in a different state, and my family not being there for me. Then guess what? They have to hop on the plane and try and get to me in a quickly manner of time. That's what kept me in the right state of mind. And that's what kept me grounded, because I was at, like I said, one of the lowest points in my life going through that, and just uncertainty, because I'm just being told that I'm lucky to be alive. Or lucky I'm not, my brain isn't a noodle.
I'm sure that scared the living bejesus out of you at that point too.
This was the following day. And like, I'm just thinking 2 days later. Cause you know, the game was Saturday, Sunday, you know, I got released Saturday night, went to the facility on Sunday. I mean, everyone was able to see me. Everyone was all good and everything. But then that Monday, I'm just thinking, okay, this probably was a stinger, because I still had a little bit of burning sensation in my arm. So I'm thinking, all right, maybe it would have been a little stinger. But then when they're able to really show me the severity of the injury, I didn't know how to process that. I'm like, all right, now I'm being told I can't play football ever again. I'm like, all right, this hasn't even been a week yet. It hasn't even been a month. And I'm just being told this. Being able to have the right people in my circle looking out for me, because, you know, I was, as silly as I was trying to make a return to play. You know,
I remember seeing it in the Times. Yeah.
So I did all the consultations. You know, the injury happened in October. I took time off, and guess what? I was back running with the team in January. I was running. So I was lifting weights, heavy weight, but I wasn't doing anything above my head. So they made sure to like, okay, you could do curls, you could do all the I believe I was doing like a lot of lunges, stuff like that, tricep work, back work, but there was never anything overhead. Never.
And I presume the strength conditioning coach was overseeing this, monitoring you, athletic training staff at UCLA, all making sure that you were doing it right, good form.
100%.
And protecting you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was having an outstanding condition. I was like in shape, still running. I mean, like I was doing well. And then it was like, okay, we're dragging this along. What is your decision? What are you going to be doing? And I was just so scared when I was being told that, you know, one, I'm going to need to have surgery for a better living of life, but being told that they're going to go through the front of my neck, I'm scared. I'm like, all right, I'm kind of trying to drag this on as long as possible. Finally, we're like, okay, we need to get this over with. We've had all the consultations. I ended up having the surgery in April. Mind you, the injury was in October of the previous year. So I just wanted to make sure I was going to be at peace with my decision and knowing that, okay, I'm going to be doing this. Every surgeon I'm talking to, I'm like, do I get a chance to play again? So I'm being told I could play again from my surgeon. I ended up doing it, and it was an outstanding outstanding operation. It was seamless, and I recovered within a month, which is usually 9 to 10 months if you're using your own bone and not a cadaver. And that was another thing. It was funny. I don't know if I ever told you this, Coach, but when I'm on the surgery table, they're asking me, like, okay, so are you going to do a cadaver or are you going to do your own bone? Pros and cons of each. And I'm like, well, I didn't really think of this. You guys are hitting me with this information now. Like, I'm kind of scared. I don't know. So then the UCLA doctor stepped in. Our football doctor, he stepped in and he told the physician, no, we're using our own bone. Trust me, you'll thank me. You'll thank me later. And he walked out. Got
that's
it done.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because I mean, literally would
have somebody. Yeah, that having a guy like that in your corner at that point in time is like having a coach trust right there.
It was my mother and my grandmother, and we're just like, all right, we don't know what to do. So imagine if he wasn't in that room. We probably would have said a cadaver. I don't know.
Right.
And that could have been a whole different recovery. But like I said, I used my own bone. I recovered within a month. Yeah, man, my family, everything. We had all the great resources that we needed, and it kept us and made everything smooth.
That's fantastic. Joel and Gabriel wanted to apologize. They had to step out, so they probably won't be able to come back for the next, God, it's almost been an hour already. It goes by quick. We've talked a lot about that injury over the years, and I'm just grateful that it turned out the way it did. Personally, because, you know, I've got to watch you grow up even more since. Would have been horrific the other way. I could only imagine, and don't want to imagine what it could have been. Seeing you and how you've been able to succeed moving forward in your life has been a fun thing for me. And I know all the people around here that I work with that have watched you grow up. Now, bringing it full circle, coming back, you said you never thought you'd be a coach. You never thought you'd be dipping your toe in there and having fun and flying around and teaching the next generation what you love to do. If you could give advice to someone that wants to be a coach or is thinking about being a coach and really isn't sure, what would it take for them to become the coach that you want to be?
Couple things. Find your niche. Find your niche. Whether it is whatever field of athletics it may be, find your niche and what makes you happy. Because if you're happy and this is what you're passionate about, it's more than just coaching. You're just out there having fun and you're teaching. Most importantly, understand what you're teaching. Be confident in what you're teaching, because guess what? These kids nowadays, they are smart. They sense if it's authentic or if it is fabricated, just because there's cameras out there and whatnot.
They're quick at that. They're quick. Nowadays, they're real quick.
They sense it, and that's what these players are gravitating towards. They want someone that is going to push them at the same time, make it fun. So, for anyone that's considering coaching out there, like I said, just you must be able to be comfortable in any environment and be able to lead people. People lead in different ways. People lead by example. Some people lead by, you know, giving instructions and information, but just have a great group around you. Cause when you're able to surround yourself with other like-minded individuals and great coaches as well, you're able to learn from them and pick information from them. And guess what? You're able to put that into your realm of things and you're able to do great things with it. So surround yourself with a great staff and a great team. And that makes it easier because teamwork makes the dream work.
That's awesome. I also think going back to one thing you said earlier, not just focusing on the sport, but developing that young man or young woman into who they should be. I think you bring that all together. You're the perfect coach at that point. Yeah. So hopefully we'll see more of those perfect coaches out there. They're far and few between, as you and I know. We've worked with them, we've played for them, but we're not always that fortunate. And we see the other end of the spectrum far too often.
Absolutely.
So we've taken plenty of your time, buddy. I appreciate you coming in and talking to us on the podcast. I'm going to let you go get on your day and be the businessman that you are nowadays. I want to thank you for joining us. Hopefully we'll have you back because a good friend of ours, and you know, you have a very unique perspective on so much in athletics and coaching. We appreciate it.
Appreciate you for having me. Look forward to it next time.
Thanks a lot, Dietrich. Have a great day, buddy.
All right, coach.
We'll talk to you later.
Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. Want to make sure you hear every episode? Remember to like, follow, and subscribe to our podcast. Don't forget to share our podcast with your colleagues, family, and friends. Your support will help more people find and enjoy our content. Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is directed by Eli Halleck. It is produced by Gabriel Halleck. Our theme music is by Coma Studios via Pixabay. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the contributors. Want to know more about us? Visit us at wrapituppodcast.com. That's with one P, wrapituppodcast.com. Wrap It Up Sports Medicine and More is a production of Halleck Consulting, LLC.